So I'll hand out the sign-in sheet when more people show up. What we're going to do is continue talking about systems and get into how to actually solve the matrix equations. So let's just review, forget about matrices for the moment, and just consider this very simple differential equation, y prime is equal to a times y. And we know how to solve that. We can separate variables. And what we find is that the solution is going to be y is equal to t e to the something t. And what symbol do I want to use? Well, it's actually going to be a. So a t, where c is your initial condition at t equals 0. And so remember last time we talked about systems and we end up writing them like this. So x prime is equal to a times x, where a is a matrix of coefficients and x is, in fact, let me just go ahead and write this out. So x is equal to a matrix x1, x2, and then your a is going to be some matrix of coefficients, A11, A12, A21, A22. And, of course, x prime, you just take the derivative of each of the components. And so that's a typical homogeneous system of equations. Homogeneous because you don't have an additional term here, which is some function of t. And so, now we look at the relationship between these two equations. So y prime equals ay, x prime equals ax. And we think maybe we can do the same sort of thing and solve this with something like x is equal to some constant e to the a times t. And there is actually a formalism when you get further along where you can take the put a matrix in the exponent of an exponential function like this. But we're not going to do that in this course. We're going to take a different approach. And so the alternative way to do this is to have, and this would be your x matrix. The alternative way to do this is to say instead what we're going to do is we're going to assume that we're going to have some constant vector here, or it's really a matrix, but I think of it as a vector, v, and then e to the lambda t, where lambda is some sort of constant, some real number. And so we're going to assume that this is the form of the solution. And now we're going to plug this into the differential equation and work this out. So again, later on, you're going to be seeing this. We're going to do a lot of this kind of stuff over the next few weeks. And you're going to you may end up wondering, well, where did it come from? Well, we get there by analogy, right? We know how to solve this equation. I haven't written out the procedure, but basically we write this as dy dt, and then we separate variables, and we solve, and we get this. And so if you look at the form of this and the form of this, the system has a very similar form, so we're going to assume a form which is very similar. Instead of having a constant C, we're going to have a constant matrix, V. And we'll have a constant here, which we don't know. And we're going to figure out what it is for any particular problem. And now I'm going to use that. I'm going to plug it into the differential equation. And we're going to see what happens. So stop me at any point if I'm going too fast or if I say something that doesn't quite make sense. So let's take our differential equation. So x prime equals ax, and we're assuming that x is equal to v. And by the way, try to get into the habit of using the same notation. And some of this is in the textbook and some of it is not, so you might want to keep track of this. So x is equal to v e to the lambda t. And so if I differentiate this, I get x prime is equal to, so what would the derivative of this be? Lambda v e to the lambda t. V is a constant, so the derivative, it's a multiplicative constant, so you don't have to use the product rule or anything like that. Now we're going to plug this in, so we get lambda v e to the lambda t, that's the left side here, is equal to a, and then x is v e to the lambda t. And the this is x, and this is x. Agreed? So what I can do is I can write a times x is equal to lambda times x. So ax equals lambda x. And after you've been around a while, and I say that, you know, when you get to higher levels in mathematics, you're going to immediately recognize this as the eigenvalue equation. So anytime you have an operator operating on some function, if you get a constant times that same function, then you can identify this as the eigenvalue. And this is the eigenvector. And you'll see that there's a lot of things that behave like eigenvalues and eigenvectors. Trigonometric functions serve that role, and you know there are just lots of things, and some of those we'll see later on in this course. But again, I want to emphasize, so think of this A as some sort of operator operating on this X, and that gives you the derivative of X. Well, A times X is equal to lambda times X, and you can see that we get there by assuming that X is of this form. Okay. Now what we need to do is figure out how to find out what lambda is. So the next step is to solve this equation. And this is going to be a little weird. It's not like your ordinary algebra. You can't divide by... if you've taken any sort of linear algebra, or if you've just even remember your college algebra, you can't divide by a matrix, first of all. Secondly, if you did, you'd have A is equal to lambda. Well, that's not even possible, because A is a matrix and lambda is a constant. You can't have a matrix equal to a constant. So your ordinary algebra doesn't work on a problem like this. So we're going to have to learn some matrix algebra. And so the next step would be to subtract lambda times x from both sides, so we get ax minus lambda x, and that's equal to zero. Now we want to factor out the x, but again, for the same reason, we can't just factor the x out, because we'll have a minus lambda inside parentheses. Now some of you, again, if you've taken linear algebra, and I think a few of you have, maybe half of you or more, then you may know what to do here. What we're going to do is we're going to introduce the identity matrix in here, which doesn't change anything, but it makes it possible to factor it. So we get AX minus lambda
times ix equals 0, so that I is the identity, and I times x is equal to x. So we haven't changed anything, but now we've made it possible to factor out the x. So I'm going to, and you have to factor it out to the right, because remember, you can't change the order of multiplication when you're talking about matrices. So now, is all of this making sense? I mean, I'm assuming that we talked a little bit about matrices last time, and you know, if I say anything that doesn't make sense, please stop me. Yes.
The identity matrix again.
Well, the identity, like, if you have 1 times 3, what is that equal to?
3.
So this is known as the multiplicative identity for real numbers. They call it the multiplicative identity because whatever you multiply it by, you keep that value, and it's an identity. But now there's an additive identity. If you have 0 plus 3, what is that equal to?
3.
So this is called the additive identity of real numbers. The multiplicative identity is 1. Well, you have a multiplicative identity for matrices. So I times A is equal to what?
A.
A. And A times I is equal to A. Now what is I? Well, if we're talking about 2 by 2, I would be 1, 0, 0, 1. And again, if you've had linear algebra, you'll know this. Or you've seen it before, you may not remember it. But one of those important things, if you multiply this matrix times any other compatible matrix, you'll get that same other matrix. So
the identity matrix only exists for square matrices.
Yeah, it only works for square matrices. Yeah, the identity always has to be square. That's true. So now I can factor the x out. So I get A minus lambda times I times x is equal to 0.
Why didn't you multiply the identity by only lambda? Why didn't you do A as well?
I didn't want to.
You can do that. You can just multiply.
Well, I didn't multiply. I'm not multiplying through by I. That's not what's going on here. I'm replacing X with I times X. Because, right, so do you believe that I times X is equal to X? Well, then all I'm doing is taking this X and replacing it by I times X. Now, what happens if you don't do that? I mean, it's important that everybody understand why we do this. What happens if we don't do that?
Is it just because it's a constant?
Yeah, but what happens? Let's say, just bring this over here, or do it from up here. Let's say, bring this down, and I'm going to factor the x out. What happens? So you get A minus lambda times x is equal to 0.
You can't. A is like a matrix, right? So you can't subtract.
Yeah, you cannot subtract a constant from a matrix. So how do you fix that?
You make lambda a matrix by multiplying by the identity.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I call it making lambda a matrix, but you're right. By doing this substitution, x becomes I times x. Now, when you factor out the x, it's A minus lambda times I. And lambda times I is a matrix. And in fact, it's a compatible matrix with A. And when I say compatible, I mean it can't be added or subtracted from that. So it's the same dimensions. Because A is square. A has to be a square matrix. We saw that before. If you have two equations and two dependent variables, then you're going to have a 2x2 coefficient matrix, and that's square. And I is square, and lambda is a constant, so lambda times I is the square matrix, then it's going to be the same size. By design, you want this I to be the same dimensions as the A. Okay, so we all clear on this? Okay. I mean, I could skip over all of the theory. This is kind of theory, and you know, just tell you how to solve the problem. But Here's the problem. When you get into the test, you're not going to necessarily know how... First of all, I think some of you are going to be curious. It's like, how does this really work? And secondly, if you get stuck, you need to know enough theory to get you out of your stuckness and be able to solve the problem. So, I think we've almost got a quorum. Let's try it. Okay. Now, this is the equation that we're going to basically solve to get lambda. And once we have lambda, then we're going to figure out what V is. Once we know lambda and V, then we have our solution to the differential equation. And so, now I have to tell you something at this point. Anytime you have a... Now, this is a matrix and this is a matrix. Agreed? If you have a matrix times a matrix and it's equal to zero, we've got to be a little careful here. It's not always true that one of these has to be zero. If you have, let's say, A times B equals zero, and these are real variables or real constants, whatever, you have this something called the zero product rule. So something times something equals zero, then either A is equal to zero or B is equal to zero. But that doesn't hold for matrices. And some of you may remember that. For example, if I have 2 0 0 0 times 0 1, so neither one of these matrices is zero, but what's the product? Zero. Right? 0 0. Because 2 times 0, 0, 1 times 0, 0, that gives you the 0. 0 times 0, 0, 0 times 1 is 0. So, and there, you can contrive other examples, and certainly this becomes more complicated when you have bigger matrices, but it is no longer true that one of them has to be 0 in order for the product to be 0. So when you solve a problem like this, you can't say that... either this is zero or this is zero. It just doesn't work with matrices. So what we're going to do instead is we're going to use determinants. Now, key idea here is we don't want X to be the trivial solution. What would the trivial solution be? What do you think?
Zero.
Or, yeah, so the matrix zero. Now, of course, if X is zero, identically zero, so that means that both X1 and X2 are zero, well, then, of course, zero times anything is zero. That still holds. But, thank you.
I don't think that was a
good thing. You didn't
do it? Yes, sir.
So we don't want a trivial solution because it's not a very interesting situation. I mean, of course, A times 0 is 0, and 0 prime is 0, and so 0 is equal to 0, and that's a trivial solution to the differential equation. And it doesn't really bias anything. It doesn't really solve the problem. Because this is, of course, going to be true for ordinary differential equations too. You know? So when we have matrices like this, we have to do something that's going to assume that X is not the trivial solution. In other words, X is not zero. But in order for this statement to be true, for this equation to be true, it turns out that it must be the case that the determinant of A minus lambda I has to equal zero. Now, this is where I'm debating about whether to show you why that's true. It's easy to show for a 2x2. It's harder to show for, you know, higher order equations, 3x3s and so on. And so at this moment, I think what I would like to do is have you just accept this on faith, that the determinant of this matrix has to be zero in order to get a non-trivial solution. And if you've had linear algebra, you will remember that.
anyway. You've seen it before. One way to think of it is if you have AX equals 0, if that's your matrix equation, this is homogeneous, and we know that the only way to get a non-trivial solution is if if this is 0, then this can be anything, but the determinant of this, the determinant of A has to be 0 in order to make this a true statement. In order, if this is not a trivial solution. So, we can circle back and pick this up later if we have time and if you have an interest. Or if we don't have time, you can certainly come to office hours. I've got a little description in my notes. I could even hand that out if you really wanted to see it. But for now, let's just assume that this determinant of this has to equal 0. And if you don't remember what a determinant is, don't worry. We're going to go over that. Okay, so to go any further, I need a specific example. And so let's use this one. So x prime is equal to 2, 3, 0, negative 5 times x. And let's assume initial conditions x of 0 is equal to 1, 1. And so what I want to do is solve this differential equation. And now I can immediately, I don't have to go through this derivation every time. A is this, and we're assuming a form of the solution, x is equal to b e to the lambda t, and if we can figure out what lambda is and what b is, then we have a solution. Now, it's going to turn out that we're going to get two solutions for lambda and two solutions for b. And so we'll have two separate solutions. They'll be different in some sense, what we would call linearly independent. And those two solutions, you can add them together and get the general solution. So we'll do this twice, solve it twice, and get the two what we call fundamental solutions. We add the fundamental solutions together to get a general solution. Okay, so I can immediately go here and say, well, the determinant of A minus lambda I, so A minus lambda I has to equal 0.
So then you have to take a derivative of X, the whole function.
Nope, I'm not substituting this back into the differential equation. I already did that. I did the theory. I know that this is what I need to do. Okay, so I mean, if you do what you're suggesting, you'll end up back here anyway. And this is where we want to be for solving the equation. Okay, so now, A minus lambda I, what is that? So A minus lambda I equals, so you have your A, which is 2, 3, 0, negative 5, minus lambda times I, 1, 0, 0, 1. And so I would simplify. So we get, these are compatible for addition. They're the same dimensions. So 2, so this becomes, minus lambda, 0, 0, lambda. So 2 minus lambda, 3, 0, and then negative 5 minus lambda. So that's A minus lambda I. Does that make sense? Huh? Did I make a mistake?
No, so you took out the determinant.
I haven't done the determinant yet.
Then how do you get that other
What?
This stuff.
A minus lambda I is equal to this minus lambda. So A minus lambda I, and this is A minus lambda I. Agreed? Everybody with me? Now, if you're just kind of nodding your head, you know, this is we're into this method of solving the equation. So you need to make sure, don't be shy, ask, because we're going to be doing this on every problem of this type from here on out. Okay, so I'm going to erase over here. Now, what is the determinant of this matrix? So, determinant of 2 minus lambda, 3, 0, negative 5 minus lambda, what does that equal? Do you guys remember?
2 minus lambda times negative 5 minus lambda.
Yeah, so this times this.
I mean, plus 0.
Minus. So 2 minus lambda times negative 5 minus lambda minus, and then 3 times 0. Now, this is a 2 by 2, which is really easy to find the determinant of. We'll see 3 by 3s a little later. We'll worry about the determinant of that then. So then, now, the 3 times 0 is 0, so I don't have to worry about this term. But now I'm going to multiply this out. So, actually, I don't have to. This is really easy, because what's the determinant of this equal to?
0.
0. Right? Determinant of A minus lambda I is equal to 0. So this is equal to 0. So 2 minus lambda times negative 5 minus lambda is equal to 0. Can we solve that? Sure. What are your values of lambda? Lambda is equal to 2 or negative 5. So now we know these are called the eigenvalues. And now one at a time, we're going to use the eigenvalues to find the corresponding V, that constant matrix. And once we have the V and the eigenvalue, and then the next V and the next eigenvalue, then we can write down the general solution. So let's pick one of them, say 2. Now, it's a good idea to get in the habit of, when you write this stuff out, you're going to compute the lambdas, and then you want to show me which lambda are you using to compute the V, and then show me the work. So, now how does this happen? How do you do this? Well, we're still looking for A minus lambda I is equal to 0. Well, this is the A minus lambda I. Now, what's the lambda that we're using here?
2.
Okay, so A minus lambda I is equal to 2 minus 2, which is 0. And then you got a 3 here and a 0 here. So 3, 0. And then negative 5 minus 2, which is negative 7. And now after a while, you won't write this step. You'll just go immediately to the next step. So, I think I erased it. I want to make sure that I actually told you. Yeah. So, remember, one of the things that I said in the derivation was A minus lambda I times V is equal to 0. right? That was part of the derivation. And then we said the only way this is going to happen, we don't want B to be the trivial solution, so the determinant of this has to be zero. And but now what we can do is we can take this matrix times B, set it equal to zero, and solve. So 0, 3, 0, negative 7 times B. Now, I'm going to use B is equal to the matrix V1, V2. And you can use, you know, any notation that you feel comfortable with, but that's a pretty common way of doing it, and you're going to have to figure out V1 and V2 separately anyway. So I'm going to put a V1 here and a V2 here, and this has to equal zero. And we're going to solve that equation for V1 and V2. Now, notice you've got a column of zeros here. Sometimes you'll have a row of zeros. If you think about it, if you remember your linear algebra, or even remember your college algebra from before, you're going to get an infinite number of solutions. There's no unique solution to this equation. What we'd like to do is make you know, writing and finding that solution, one of the solutions, easy. And if you get into the right habits, this will be easy. And so, anytime you have a situation where you have, I mean, if the determinant is zero, then what's really going on is you've got redundant equations. And so we're going to get two equations from here. One of them is either 0 equals 0, which is of no importance, or you'll find sometimes you'll get the same equation written twice, or maybe there's a minus sign through it the second time or whatever, but they're redundant equations. One is a multiple of the other. And so if that doesn't happen, if you get a unique solution from this, then you've done something wrong. You did something wrong in doing the determinant or whatever. Now, it's a little odd because usually, up to this point in your mathematical career, you've always been looking for unique solutions of problems. But here, we're actually looking for, if it's unique, then you've made a mistake. You don't want a unique solution here. You want an infinite number of solutions, but we're going to try to write the simplest one. And so let me just write the equation. So let's take this first row. You go 0 times V1 plus 3 times V2. So 0, V1 plus 3 V2, and that has to equal 0. Okay? Well, now we have to be careful how we interpret an equation like this. This is saying, forget about this term, because 0 times V1 is 0. This is saying that 3V2 is equal to 0. So do we conclude that V2 is equal to 0? Yeah, I think we're forced to do that, right? V2, in order to make this equation true, V2 has to equal 0. Okay. So, but if, what happens with V1? It could be anything, right? I want to make it simple. So what would be the simplest choice? One. Why not 0? Then it's trivial, right? If V1 is 0 and V2 is 0, then you have the trivial solution. And that is not acceptable. You don't want the trivial solution. So now you could choose any value for V1, and we're going to find it doesn't matter which one you choose, because whatever it is can get absorbed into your arbitrary constant. And so it's easiest to choose V1 is equal to 1. So already, without doing any more work, you know, just the analysis of this, I'm going to say V is equal to, so V1 is 1 and V2 is 0. So our general solution, or our
fundamental solution for this particular eigenvalue is x, and I'll call it x1, is equal to the 1, 0, e to the 2t. And that's our first solution. Now, we can multiply that by an arbitrary constant, and that's still going to be a solution, and we'll see that a little later. But now we need to use the other eigenvalue and get the other fundamental solution. So any questions up to this point? Now, I haven't proven that this is actually a solution of the differential equation, but if you plug it in, take the derivative of it and plug it into the equation, multiply by a and all of that, you'll find that it actually does work. Okay. Now, let's use the next one. So, notice I wrote lambda equals 2, and then I did the work to figure out what v is. So, this v goes with this lambda.
Don't use the second equation from this as well.
It's redundant.
Yeah, we do it with 0.
Well, it leads to the same result, right? So, 0 times v1 plus negative 7 times v2 is equal to 0. Well, the only way this equation is true is that v2 is equal to 0. And what is v1?
Anything.
What are you going to make it? So you get the same outcome.
But that doesn't mean it's unique.
No, it's not unique. Because if you can have anything for v1, that doesn't mean unique. In order to have a unique solution, I'd have to have a particular value for V1 and a particular value for V2. That's what we mean by unique. I mean, these are good questions, and you guys got to get this all clear in your head at some point. So go ahead and ask. If you had a different outcome than what you have here, maybe these equations are not redundant. Maybe your determinant wasn't really zero. If that's the case, then you might want to go back and check your work to make sure you did this part or the earlier part correct. You know, usually the hard part of these problems is going to be solving this equation. Now, this one's easy, but they're not always going to be so easy. Especially if we had something that's non-zero here. This is by design. Right? If you put something that's non-zero, let's say a 1, you subtract 3, your eigenvalues are no longer these numbers, and then you got to multiply it all out and refactor it and solve it, and hopefully you can factor and get the eigenvalues. Question? No? Yes?
Earlier we said that ax minus lambda x is equal to 0. Where did you get the b?
Well, when I plugged in, so I said... you know, I said AB is equal to lambda B. And I said, this is the eigenvalue, this is the eigenvector. Subtract this from both sides. So we get AB minus lambda B is equal to 0. And replace... Did I do it with X?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't want to do that. Yeah, I have that written in the previous line. But so yeah, so it's now replace the v with the i times v, so we get a v minus lambda I v equals 0, and so you get a minus lambda I times v. Yeah, if I wrote x here, that was not correct. And you guys should have caught me on that. Yes.
So the earlier where you were writing x, or
if I wrote an x here, then I meant to write a v. And
yeah.
Chris is up in the corner. You have x.
Well, this is the solution, and so this is our initial condition, and this is a minus lambda I right here. Yes. In the back.
So then, your v is your eigenvector, not your x.
Yeah. I mean, x is also an eigenvector. But because it's still, it's also true that ax is equal to lambda x. This is a true statement also. But what we need is, for solving this, we need this. Yes?
But in the previous thing you did, you substituted v, e, lambda, t as x.
Yes.
And then that's how you go to ax equals lambda x. So this time you would...
But this is just a typo on my part. So go back and figure out where I made my mistake and just fix it. So, I mean, it should be easy to fix. Somewhere along here I had the right thing, and I probably started with this one instead.
I factored out the X,
but I should have been at this point here, and then you subtract this from both sides, and you get, you know, you get this. It works the same way, actually. But I'm not interested in finding x directly. I need to find v. And so this would be, this also is a true statement.
So I guess the confusion here is why av equals lambda v comes from a equals lambda x.
Okay.
It's not just you dividing out the u lambda.
Okay, let me do the derivation again. So x prime equals ax. X is equal to V e to the lambda t, and so x prime is equal to lambda v e to the lambda t, and then substitute this in, so you get lambda v e to the lambda t equals a v e to the lambda t. And now, this was your x. This is also your x. But I could also have just divided out the e to the lambda t. And so, if I do that, so at this point, let me do a v is equal to lambda v. Now, do you believe it? So I apologize for that misstep on the derivation, but instead of replacing this whole thing with x, let's just divide out the e to the lambda t, and you get here, and then it works the same way. So you can subtract the ax from both sides, and you get the same equation. But I don't want to solve for x that way. I want to solve for v, and so I want to do it this way, and then subtract this from both sides, and then replace the v with iv. And then factor the x out and do the determinant, and then you get to where we need to be. Okay? Okay. So now we're going to do the next eigenvalue. So lambda is equal to negative 5. And I'm just going to go ahead and write a minus lambda I. So a minus lambda I. So here's the a minus lambda I. And I plug in lambda is equal to negative 5. So what do you get here? 7, 3, 0, and 0. And then V1, V2. And what does that have equal?
Zero.
Okay?
And then you say that if V1 is zero and V2 is zero, then it's a
trivial solution.
Trivial.
And we don't want trivial. I mean, think about it. If X is equal to V E to the lambda T, if V is zero, zero, then that times this is going to give you zero, and then your solution is zero. That's a pretty uninteresting solution.
So we don't want the trivial solution. Okay? Now here, notice we've got two zeros along the bottom. Here we've got two zeros along the left column. You're not guaranteed to always have zeros, especially when we get into complex eigenvalues, and if you have a 3x3, you're not always going to have a zero row or zero column. But if you do this right, you should get redundant equations and no unique solution. So let's write this out. 7v1 plus 3v2 is equal to 0. And then 0 is equal to 0 is the other equation. So that's not very interesting. Now, you can solve this in different ways, and I don't really care. I usually take this first one and solve for the v1. So v1 is equal to negative 3v2 over 7. And you can, any value for v2 will work. And then you're going to get a particular value for v1. But I want to keep this really simple. I don't want fractions if I can avoid them. Not that we have anything against fractions. But if, let's say we choose v2 is equal to 7, then we can avoid the fractions. So v then is equal to what? Well, v2 is what?
7.
And that makes v1 equal to what?
-3.
So that's your v vector. And because there are an infinite number of ways of doing this, you might say, well, how can that work? Well, you're really off by just a multiplicative constant, and that multiplicative constant can be absorbed into your arbitrary constant. And so it doesn't matter what this is, as long as it's in the right proportion. As long as this equation is obeyed, then you're going to get the right answer. So now we have we have x1 here. Let me write x2, which is equal to -3/7 e to the -5t. These are known as fundamental solutions. And that word is going to be important later on. If the textbook asks you what are the fundamental solutions, these are the fundamental solutions of this problem. Not with the arbitrary constants that are out in front, which I haven't written here. These by themselves are the fundamental solutions. Yes?
Why is the 3v2 positive?
Is there a negative in front of the 3 and the...
Never mind, I thought...
This, why is this positive?
Is there not a negative sign there? Never mind, I was seeing that wrong. Sorry.
Yeah, the off-diagonal elements are actually not going to change. When you do A minus lambda I, the I only has diagonal values that are non-zero, 1 and 1. So you get a 2 minus lambda here, you get a -5 minus lambda here, and these numbers don't change. So that should be 3. So 3, 0, 3, 3, 0, 3, 0, those are all the same. What changes are these diagonal elements when we plug in the proper value of lambda. Okay, so now what we can do is we can write the general solution. We'll say x is equal to c1 x1 plus c2 x2, or more particularly, x is equal to c1 1, 0, e to the 2t plus c2, -3/7, e to the -5t. Yes?
Should we always expect a redundant solution when you multiply the a and b?
The a and b.
A, b.
The a and the b. The determinant of this matrix is zero, So one of the equations has to be a multiple of the other. So that gives, that means that that's what we mean by a redundant equation. And if you use the other equation, you should get exactly the same answer. Now here, you can see, begin to see now, if I chose, let's say, negative 6, 14, for some reason, for that, if I preferred that answer, well, that's really just the factor of 2 that could have been absorbed into the C2. And this is C2 and C1 are arbitrary constants at this point. I haven't matched the boundary conditions. In fact, let's go ahead and do that, the initial conditions. What was the initial condition on this problem? X of 0 is equal to 1, 1. So let's go ahead and apply that initial condition.
So the official, like the, that's like the real solution for X. It's the combination of X1 and X2.
That's right. So there are two solutions. Now, for some reason, I wanted to make this solution 0. This one will satisfy the differential equation. And vice versa. But in order to satisfy the initial condition, we're going to find out what C1 and C2 have to be. And then those constants are no longer arbitrary. Just like before, we have an equation, we solve it, we've got an arbitrary constant, plug in the initial condition, now that constant's no longer arbitrary. Because we have two equations here, it's a system of two equations, then we're going to have two arbitrary constants. Okay? Everybody good with this? These are all good questions. So let's go ahead and figure out how this works. So I'm going to go ahead and put 1, 1 here equals C1, 1, 0. Now, if T is 0, E to the 0 is 1. And then C2, negative 3, 7. E to the 0 is 1. So we'd have to solve this equation. Now, in general, this might require that you solve a system of equations. But this one's easier because it has a 0 here. Right? So we can just solve it by inspection. So C1 times 0 plus C2 times 7 is equal to 1. So C2 times 7 is equal to 1. So C2 times 7 is equal to 1. So C2 is equal to 1/7. And now this top equation, 1 is equal to C1 minus 3C2. But C2 is 1/7, so 1 is equal to C1 minus 3/7. Add 3/7 to both sides. So 7/7 plus 3/7 is 10/7. So C1 is equal to 10/7. And so now our general solution that satisfies the initial condition is X is equal to 10/7, 1/0, e to the 2t, plus 1/7, negative 3/7, e to the negative 5t. And that's the solution of our differential equation. Okay? If we had chosen different values, let's say instead of choosing a 1 here, we'd chosen a 2, then we'd end up probably with another number here. Let's say if this was the same, then this would probably be 5/7 or something. Okay? Now this is about as simple as it gets for these kinds of problems. Yes?
So technically we solved two equations as our solution. Because if we didn't write in matrix...
Well, it's a single matrix equation.
But we could have 2 3.
X prime is equal to AX. That's a single matrix equation, but what does this represent? It represents 2 first order linear homogeneous differential equations. So this is a way to write it in a matrix form. Okay? Now, what I was saying, you know, when you have, these are real eigenvalues, so lambda is equal to -5 and lambda is equal to 2, those are both real eigenvalues. What we're going to find is that eigenvalues come in complex conjugate pairs. So if they turn out to be complex, then we're going to do something a little different. We can also get repeated eigenvalues. These are distinct eigenvalues. If the eigenvalues are repeated, then we have a different method of solution. Similar, but different enough that you have to remember it as a different procedure. So this is really about as easy as it gets for this course in terms of the systems. Now I want to show you one more thing, which is the phase portrait for this. And the whole point of doing a system like this, we could turn this into a second order linear differential equation probably and solve it without having to go through this all this rigmarole. But one of the important things about a matrix approach and a system approach to the differential equation is that now we can see the phase portrait and that we can see the equilibria. In this case, there's one equilibrium, and we can see what it's doing around that equilibrium. So I've got the solution here. Let me erase this over here. Any questions on this stuff before I erase it? Okay, so I'm going to draw the phase portrait. And there's some simple rules for drawing the phase portraits. I need to be able to see all of the features that are important. So you're going to have x1, x2. Obviously, drawing a face portrait for a 3x3 is going to be impossible. So you can use computers to do that, but for us, we're only going to draw these by hand if it's a 2x2. And well, I didn't mention it last time, but the equilibrium position, so if you have x prime is equal to a times x, what is the equilibrium for that?
Zero.
Yep, so what would the equilibrium solution be? How do you get x prime equal to zero?
Determinant of a equals zero.
Ah, you're overthinking it. This is one place where, we don't know that the determinant of A is zero. In fact, generally speaking, the determinant of A is not going to be zero. The determinant of A minus lambda I is zero, but not the determinant of A. So we can't assume that. And let's assume, in fact, for just the purpose of discussion here, the determinant of A is not zero. Well, then how do you get zero from AX equals zero? X has to equal zero. In other words, the equilibrium point is right in the middle, right at the origin. Okay? So now, these actually tell you quite a bit about the phase portrait. So this vector is telling you along which direction do we have this eigenvalue of 2. And notice this is a growth term, right? As t gets bigger, e to the 2t gets bigger, and whatever your solution is, it's going to take off. It's going to go to, you know, large values. Whereas here, t is getting larger, e to the minus 5t is getting smaller, and so this term actually approaches the origin.
But now you've got some connection between these two. From some points in the plane, it's going to get bigger, and other points, it's going to get smaller. And so we'll see what happens here. So you want to draw the vector 0, 1. So what is 0, 1? Well, it's the vector 0, 1 points upward. Did I say 1? I'm sorry, you're right. I saw 1, 0, and I thought 0, 1. Okay, so yeah. So that vector points to the right. Thank you.
Okay. And so...
X1's on bottom, X2's on top.
Yes, thank you. So now it's going to go away. If you have a positive eigenvalue, then it's going to go away from the origin. And actually, you're going to have your other direction this way. So it's going to leave the origin with a positive eigenvalue. So they're going to be along a line radiating from the equilibrium point. Now let's plot the other one, -3, 7. So say -1, -2, -3, 7, something like this. So you've got this vector and then the other side. So you have your eigenvalue is 2 here and it's -5 this way. Okay. Now, anytime you have a positive eigenvalue, it goes away from the equilibrium point. Anytime you have a negative eigenvalue, it goes toward the equilibrium point. And what's going to happen is it's going to do something like this. So you get it'll come in probably parallel or slightly closer to this line, and it's trying to go to the origin, but then you can see it's also trying to be increased by this positive eigenvalue. And so what you're going to find is, now what's it going to do if I start here, let's say?
It's
going to
go off to the left.
Yeah, it's going to go off to the left like this. Now we can quibble about exactly how close it gets and so on. To do that properly, you would need a computer to figure all that out. But now what happens if you're over here? Let's say you start here. What's going to happen? Well, it's going to move toward the origin, but then it's going to circle back and head out away from the equilibrium. And likewise here, if you start here, you're going to end up over here.
Why does it travel up?
Why does it what?
Why does it travel up? Why does it not travel down?
So, think of it as being under the influence of forces of some sort. So, you're at this point, you're being predominantly controlled by this negative eigenvalue. And what is that going to do? It's going to drive you toward the origin. But as you get closer to this line here, the positive eigenvalue is going to start to take over, and you're going to be pushed out this way.
So the negative moves zero.
I'm sorry? Negative eigenvalue goes toward zero, or toward the equilibrium. I want to say it generally like that. In this case, the equilibrium is the origin. So you're moving toward the origin if you're moving along. And by the way, if you're on this line somehow, you know, it's an unstable equilibrium. You're heading this way, and you're going to get to the origin. But it's an asymptotic approach, like we talked about. So you never actually get there. But if you're perturbed and you're off the line a little bit, then the other eigenvalue will start to take over at some point as you get close enough. Now, I'm being very qualitative here, and so I want you to take that, you know, some of what I say with a little bit of a grain of salt. It's
this is what the face portrait would look like, and we're going to do it on a computer at some point, but you can sketch these pretty well by hand. One more comment here. Some of you like to draw lots and lots of these curves, and I would say you don't need to draw as many curves. Maybe one or two curves would be enough to illustrate what's going on. Yes?
So you do those lines because they're the magnitude of the x vector, but the direction of the x vector, the magnitude of the eigenvalue?
The magnitude of this vector doesn't have anything to do with anything.
Yeah, what I was saying is...
What matters is the magnitude of the eigenvalue. And so I drew the vector just because, like, this was -3.7. That's not quite right.
Yeah.
I don't have a scale on either my x1 or my x2 axis, but, you know, it goes up like this somehow. And then this one was 1.0.
So those are the directions.
Those are the directions of the v's.
But the magnitude is the eigenvalues.
The thing that drives the solution is the size and the sign of the eigenvalues. Okay?
So, if you have any initial position in this graph...
Let's say your initial position is here.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Right.
You're probably going to down to the right a little bit. Yeah, something like that.
So, basically, the closer you are to a line parallel to...
If you're on one of these curves, then you're just going to follow the curve.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like a direction field. Yes?
So you plot that based on the... So, like, -3 is x1 and following is x2? For the line that you do with the two -5s on it? You know how to do the line based on x1 and x2.
Correct.
The slope of the line?
Well, you draw these lines that come from these vectors. Mm-hmm. And now one thing that happens is we didn't talk about this last time, but I think the book mentions that if you want to know what is the direction at a particular point in space, I mean, why are we doing all this? Well, because we want to get a general solution, we want to get a face portrait that kind of paints the big picture, okay? What if I'm here and I just want to know what direction am I going to move immediately? Well, all I have to do is take A times X, where X now is your X1, X2, and just plug in. So let's, for example, if I say A times 2.2. Well, what was A? I erased it. It's 2.3.0 -5. So... 2.3.0 -5 and 2.2. So 4 + 6 = 10, 0 - -10. So if I'm here, I'm going to go in this direction, so 10 - -10. So it's approximately down like that. Now, it's only good for a very small distance, right? Infinitesimal distance. Because it's a calculus. It's only that slope, that this direction vector, is only valid at that point, and then it changes to something else. So you can see, I haven't got the curves quite right. They're, you know, it's a little steeper at this point. But that's, if you want to know exactly what's happening at a particular point, you can just take your A times your X, because that is what X prime is, and that's going to be the direction that you're going, the rate of change of X1 and X2 with respect to T.
for solutions like this, would it be sensible to say that the line, that the graph is essentially asymptotically stable around the eigenvector?
Well, this is, okay, so this is known as a saddle. And it's a saddle because it wants to be asymptotically stable along this line, but it wants to be unstable along this line. So think calculus 3. This it's different equations, different kind of problem, but you know it's kind of like the saddle that you saw in calculus 3. And the now we're going to have situations where they'll all come in. Both of these will come in, and then that would be an asymptotically stable equilibrium. Or they're all going out, which is unstable. But here, you know, I thought it'd be a little easier, a little nicer to lead with a one that has a positive eigenvalue and a negative eigenvalue, and then you end up with a saddle. And so these actually are pretty easy to draw. Sometimes the unstable are a little harder. And it just depends on the angle. Sometimes if they're very close together, an angle, like small angle, it's hard to draw them. And you got to be careful. Okay, other questions on this? So we're going to be seeing several of these. Let me do one more. I think I can do one more. That one. Sure.
Is this still
8.1? No.
Three three. Okay.
So we finished last week. We did 8.1 and 3.2. And this week we're going to do 3.3, 3.4, 3.5.
Okay. So eigenvalue is sub 3.3.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay,
so let's do this one. So I'm going to erase all of this. Now this one should go a lot faster because I don't have to do all the derivations and stuff. So let's say that x prime is equal to 4, 0, 3, 6 times x. And I'm not given an initial condition on this one. And so this, of course, is your A. And what we want is, so A minus lambda I, and the determinant of that has to equal zero. So the first step is always to find the lambdas. Once you know the lambdas, then you can take each one of them and use each one separately to find the corresponding V, the eigenvector. And so I'm just going to compute A minus lambda I here. So it's 4 minus lambda 0 is 3, 6 minus lambda. Now we still haven't gotten anything interesting yet in terms of computing the lambdas, because the determinant of this is still going to be, so 4 minus lambda times 6 minus lambda equals 0. And so what's lambda? Lambda is equal to 4 or 6. Okay? So now let's say lambda is equal to 4. So our A minus lambda I becomes
So I look at this, with the one with the lambdas in it, not this one, but this one, and I subtract the lambda. So 4 minus 4 is 0, and this is 0, this stays 3, and then 6 minus 4 is 2, and now I want to figure out what the b's are, so b1, b2, and that has to equal 0. So 0b1 plus 0b2 equals 0, so 0 equals 0 doesn't tell you anything. So we use the other equation. So 3b1 plus 2b2 is equal to 0. Solve for either one, but I usually solve for this first one. So 3b2 is equal to negative 2, I'm sorry, 3b1 is equal to negative 2b2. So b1 is equal to negative 2/3 B2. And now our B B2 is equal to what? What's the easiest choice to make? There are an infinite number of possibilities and you are free to use any of them, but the easy one is always the one that gets rid of this denominator and gives you an integer over here. So if B2 is equal to 3, then B1 is equal to what? Negative 2. So now we know lambda and we know V and we have the solution. That fundamental solution. And I'll write them down later. But now let's do the next one. Lambda is equal to 6. So again, A minus lambda I. So 4, use this one, 4 minus 6 is negative 2, 0, 3, 6 minus 6 is 0. And then your B1, B2 equals 0, 0. So, either one of these equations will give you the information that you need. You don't need to do both of them. Now, it probably doesn't hurt you if you do both of them, but you might be tempted, I don't know, I have mixed feelings about this. If you fiddle with both equations, you might get confused and end up with a wrong answer somehow. If you did this part right, this part here, and got the lambdas correct, then this has to be what we call singular, and therefore you have at least one redundant equation in there, and so you should only need to process one of the equations. So negative 2b1 plus 0b2 is equal to 0. What does that tell you about b1? B1 has to be 0. So if B1 is 0, then what does B2 have to be?
It could be anything.
It could be anything, but
it probably should be 1.
Probably should be 1. That's the easy one. So I'll put a 1 here. You know, minus 1 wouldn't be bad either, but if you guys will get in the habit of doing these easy things, then hopefully the rest of it will go a little easier. Okay, so now our final solution is x is equal to c1, and then this b1, so negative 2, 3, e to the, and you have to get the lambda right, so 4t, plus c2, and it doesn't matter which one you call C1 and C2. It makes no difference. 0, 1, e to the 6t. And that's your general solution. Now, both of these eigenvalues are positive. And so this thing is going to race away from the origin. Origin is still going to be the equilibrium point. But
It's no longer a saddle. The saddle you got when you had one of the eigenvalues being negative and one of them being positive. So, and notice, that didn't take very long at all to do, right? Again, the hard part, if it's going to be hard at all, is figuring out what these the eigenvalues are. Yes?
Is there only a, so there's only singularity in this case because it's already a zero in the A vector, right?
We're insisting that the determinant of A minus lambda I is zero. That kind of came out of the derivation. And because determinant of A minus lambda I is equal to zero, it means that this matrix is singular. There's a theorem in linear algebra that the determinant of a matrix is zero, that's equivalent to, it's singular, it does not have an inverse, you know, it's, there's some other...
So no matter what, you should turn out with that. Even if there's random numbers in the A vector, not just zeros.
You should have an infinite number of choices.
Okay.
And if you don't, then, you know, if you get a unique solution, then you did something wrong. Okay, so x1, x2, and now first thing we have to do is plot these vectors. So negative 2, 3. And I guess if you try to be really accurate, then, you know, it matters where these vectors are. And label the line with the appropriate eigenvalue. So lambda is equal to 4. Lambda is equal to 4. Otherwise, it's real easy to get confused. And then the other one is 0, 1. So 0, 1. So it's up like this. And so lambda is equal to 6. And then down like this, lambda is equal to 6. Now, what's going to happen here is they're going to race away from the origin. They're going to probably start with parallel to the smaller one, but then it's going to turn and become, I'm sorry, so yeah, parallel or tangential to the smaller one, and then it's going to eventually become parallel to the larger one. So here you're going to go like if you're here, you're going to you start parallel to the smaller one and then you're going to eventually go parallel to the larger one. You see how that happened?
The one with the higher eigenvalue?
The bigger eigenvalue, which is here, is going to take over. And so if you're here or here, whatever, you'll probably start, you're going to move away from the origin, but you're going to move in a line that's parallel to the x equals 4, but as you get further away, you're going to be turned until you're now parallel to the larger eigenvalue. So let's say we start over here. What's going to happen? Well, you might start this way, but then you're going to eventually turn and go north and end up being parallel. So it's not going to be straight lines out away from the origin, because that's just not how it works. Okay? And, you know, this all becomes a lot easier with a computer, but I do at least want to see some of these lines drawn, some of these curves. Questions on this? Okay. Okay. Now we'll have an opportunity to look at more of these, and I think hopefully you're going to have some questions on the homework when you do some of these, and when you do, then we can
we'll take advantage of that time and go over some more examples. Yes?
Speaking of homework, you also have A2 and A3, and then just optional homeworks.
Well, so if they have an asterisk, the asterisk means that those are the problems that you would do if we talked about A2 and A3, but we didn't talk about either one of those. We only did A1. So those are not assigned. You'll be happy about that, I think. So, and someone mentioned that there's a problem with the assignment at 8-2 anyway, but it's somehow the same as the one in 8-1. I don't know. But we're not responsible for 8-2 and 8-3 this semester. We don't have enough time to get through those sections. I consider them to be less important. I mean, I've heard teachers say they want, you know, they'd like some coverage of 8-3. And I did mention Rangakutta, but I'm not going to have you do any problems with it. When you have to do it in real life, you'll just figure it out. It's not that hard. No, it's really not. It's just a formula you just plug in. Yes?
What section are due for homework?
8-1 and 3-2. Those are due this Thursday. And if you... Nobody came to my office hours today with questions about homework, so if you have questions about homework, you should come see me. And then if that's not enough time, we can spend some time in class. Or if there are enough people that have a question about a homework problem, I'm happy to look at it. Okay? So I think what I want to do now is start into the complex eigenvalues. And because the complex eigenvalues are a little bit more complicated than real eigenvalues. Now the repeated, I think, are actually worse than the complex, but we'll get those on Thursday. You need to do a little bit of theory on these complex eigenvalues. I assume none of you have had a course in complex analysis. Is that a fair statement? So, in trigonometry, if you took trig, and I don't think we even teach it in trigonometry or in pre-calculus, but there... Usually in the textbook, there's some mention of this fact. If you have something like e to the I theta, or I'm going to use phi, e to the I phi. Now, this is a complex function because I is what?
Square root of negative 1.
So, now, if... Especially since we're talking about complex numbers and complex eigenvalues, if you see an I, pretty good clue that that's the what we call the imaginary unit, square root of negative 1. Otherwise, I could be an index and a sum, or it could be, you know, I hat, and a unit vector, it could be different things. But here, I mean for I to be square root of negative 1. And so I squared... is equal to 1. Now, I'm not going to go through a whole lengthy discussion.
Equals negative 1, right?
Thank you. Yes. I'm not going to go through a lengthy discussion of complex numbers. If you need that, probably, you know, look it up. But I will say that this is equal to, anybody know?
Sine
theta. You got it almost right. So cosine phi plus I sine phi. This is known as Euler's identity. By the way, it is pronounced Euler, not Euler. The Euler identity is famous. We use it all the time in various branches of mathematics. The nice thing about it is that you can take sines and cosines and turn them into exponentials, and oftentimes the algebra is easy with exponentials. And that's exactly what we're going to do with it here. And you'll often see e to the z, where z is a complex number, so z is equal to a plus, let me do it this way, x plus iy. So x is a real number, y is a real number, and so as you may remember, some of you probably wrote it as a plus bi. So a and b are real numbers, x plus x and y are real numbers, and then x plus I times y is a complex number. So we often use the shorthand notation z for that. And so e to the z would be e to the x plus iy. But because of the properties of exponents, exponential functions, this is equal to e to the x times e to the iy. And so this is equal to e to the x, which is a real function, we understand e to the x perfectly well, times, and then using Euler's identity, cosine, now here I'm using y instead of phi, so I have to use y here, so cosine y plus I sine y. And what often happens, and I'll just mention this, if x is negative, then you're going to get exponential decay, but then you've got these sinusoids, which are periodic, and so you can get exponentially decaying sinusoids. And so that often happens with this kind of function. Now, there are various ways of deriving the Euler identity. The most common way is to use power series expansions. If you have the power series expansion for cosine and you have the power series expansion for sine, then, and you multiply the sine power series by I and go through the algebra, you can find that you get the power series for e to the whatever, where this whatever is I times phi. And I don't particularly like that approach because it seems, I mean, you have to memorize the power series expansions, or, you know, the question in my mind is, does any of this make any sense for complex value functions? If you haven't had a course in complex analysis, you may not appreciate that statement, but you know, like complex logarithm behaves very differently than the real logarithm. Right? If I I'm not going to try to come up with an example right now, but there's another way to derive this, and I actually have worked this out myself, and I think I've seen it in other books, but you can use some properties of exponential functions and some basic properties of complex functions and use differential equations to derive this. And I have in my notes, you know, if I felt like I had plenty of time, I would just go ahead and write down the derivation for you, because it's kind of cool. But in any case, what you need to do is just accept this on faith, or else go look it up. So Euler's identity, like I say, pretty important. So, so that's kind of the prelude to what's coming. So let's talk about a differential equation site. So like y double prime plus y is equal to zero. Now we haven't talked about this particular differential equation yet. But it's well known in physics, and if this were a minus sign, then you would have an exponential decay property. But because of the plus sign, you know you're going to get sinusoidal solutions. And how do we know that? Well, suppose, we can just guess the answer, right? So let's let y equal a cosine t plus b sine t. And a and b are constants. Then y prime is equal to negative a sine t plus b cosine t. And then y double prime is equal to negative a cosine t minus b sine t. And we plug in to here, so we plug in negative a cosine t minus b sine t plus y, which is a cosine t plus b sine t. Well, that should equal zero, right? And notice I put a question mark over the equal sign and write equals zero, but with a question mark, because I'm not sure it's equal yet. By the way, anytime you plug in and check to see whether something satisfies the differential equation, you should always use some indication that you're not sure. I use the question mark, but you know, words work too. So, and then negative a cosine t plus a cosine t, these guys cancel. Negative b sine t and positive b sine t, those guys cancel. And so you get 0 is equal to 0, so it checks. So this actually is a solution to the to that differential equation. For any a and b, so I can now use an initial condition and figure out what a and b have to be. Okay, so now I want to solve that same equation in a different way. Remember we said that if y prime is equal to ay, then we can assume that y is equal to c e to the at. Well, if you have a, now this is the first order, if you have a second order, a good guess for the answer would be, let's let y is equal to c e to the lambda t. So we're not making any claims about what lambda is. Over here we assumed that lambda was a, but that was because this was first order and separable. But this is not separable. It's first order, but it's not separable. So, but we can guess that this is the answer. And in fact, a lot of, you know, this is how I learned to do these equations a long time ago. You assume a form of a solution like this and you plug in and see what happens. So, why? So we, what we want is to solve that equation, right? We're looking to solve this thing. So y prime is c lambda e to the lambda t. Y double prime is c lambda squared e to the lambda t. And now plug in, so you get c lambda squared e to the lambda t plus c lambda e to the lambda t equals zero. And the e to the lambda t can never be zero, so you can divide that out.
Wouldn't it just be c e to the lambda t for the second part?
You're right, thank you. And yeah, I don't know where I got. I guess I was trying to get look at this one, but I looked at this one. So then, now, so I'm canceling the e to the lambda t. What else can I cancel? the c's. And so what you're left with is lambda squared plus 1 is equal to 0. And lambda squared plus 1 equals 0. Lambda squared is equal to negative 1. Lambda is equal to plus or minus the square root of negative 1, which is the same as plus or minus I. And so now we have complex eigenvalues. And by the way, this is an eigenvalue in the same sense that the eigenvalues we were talking about before are eigenvalues. Now, we're not going to pursue this method any further than this. What this would say is, therefore, y, we're looking at this one here, so y is equal to c1 e to the I t plus c2 e to the negative I t. Now things get a little funky because these are complex conjugates and there's some stuff that we have to do. I would not call this the answer because these are not real functions. We don't know what to do with them yet. We're not going to even worry about this method. What we're going to do instead is we're going to go to a third method of solving this equation. And I think I'll wait until Thursday to do that because I don't have enough time to really even start it. So when we come back on Thursday, what I'm going to do is we'll have a quiz, we'll turn in the homework, and we'll start solving this. If you didn't sign the sign-in sheet, do that before you leave. And by the way, I might as well go ahead and hand out the homeworks and stuff. I've got 3 minutes, so if you would. David Talbot, come on up and help me out here. Josh.
Thank you.
Kevin. Samuel. Adrian. Henry. Anastasia. Michael's not here. Mohammed. Johnson. Matthew. Tyler. Pedro. Ted. Oh, sorry, one more. Aaron A. Daniel. Riley. Jason. Eduardo. Okay. Yes.